three things came clear to me in that moment, which, yeah, the way I would describe is faith, hope, and love. Faith that everything that I had done up till that point was the best that Connor, at the age and with the experience, could have done. The girlfriend that I left in a way that I wish I didn't when I was 23, that was the best that Connor at 23 could do. The fact I could regret by 33 is I was wiser. Not signing the deal to sell the company 3 months before Lehman's bankruptcy, that was the best that Connor at that point could do. And I remember this element of faith was just a huge compassion for myself, for all the versions of myself in the past, for all the flawed decisions, but they're flawed from where I look now. But back then, they were the best decision that me at that age with that experience could have taken. And faith is you and I, there's a reason we are talking right now. The listener listening to this podcast, there's a reason that they're hearing my voice and your voice at this time. And if we pay attention, there is something for us here. We may discover it now, we may discover it in a week, we may never discover it. But to me, faith is this, that there's nothing broken, there's nothing we've done wrong, there's nothing to regret. A regret is a wonderful thing, it means you're wise. To regret your past action is to be wise now. But you need to know that 10 years from now, you're gonna look back and see how unwise.
You regret it, yeah.
So you're gonna look back with compassion on the Christoph of today.
Herzlich willkommen zum On the Way to New Work Podcast. Heute remote als Corona-Session und heute ohne Michael Trautmann. Christoph Magnussen ist hier. Ich sitze im Studio and I will switch to English because on my Hangout screen here is my good friend Connor Neal from Barcelona. And it's late in the evening, 9 o'clock, and we do a podcast. Thank you, Connor.
Pleasure to be here with you, Christoph.
We just chatted when we started the podcast, how long it has been ago that we talked to each other. I think it was before my TED Talk. You gave me a call and you gave me again one of the best advices for holding a speech, giving a talk. And this is how we actually met. It was in December 2016, Washington, D.C. It was cold and I realized this guy speaking there has 30,000 YouTube followers. I'm like, holy shit. And he's my coach. I gotta make a YouTube video with him. I think I had like 800 followers back then or something like that. And I found myself on the rooftop of that hotel with you. And this started a journey between you and me, keeping each other accountable for making videos. I thanked you for that.
That deal between you, me, and Rich, I think True. Were the three that just agreed YouTube. You know, I think I'd noticed at the time that about half of my requests to give speeches, to come and deliver workshops, were coming not from the business school that I teach at, not from EO, not from the world of association. It was coming from people who had seen my videos on YouTube.
Love it.
And in Washington, I remember just, you know, you had the kit, I had the desire, Rich had some great ideas, and we committed to holding each other accountable that one video per week goes up onto YouTube.
And we stuck to that. I can see your play bar in the background. We will definitely talk about that in a moment. I have to give a little bit of background for people knowing you. You're now a YouTuber, but you're a teacher. You taught leadership communication at the IESE in Barcelona. And you're right now the president of Vistage in Spain, the world's leading CEO organization, actually. And I met you through EO, Entrepreneurs Organization. You were teaching speaking, like persuasion, how you say, the art of moving people to action. And I had to give a speech in like 3 minutes and train it and rehearse it. And this is how we met. But this is who you are today, but there is a story before that and how you become that person. So for anyone sitting here who doesn't know you, who are you and how have you become the person you are today?
And I think there's the long version, the medium version, and the short version. And we're probably somewhere on the medium version here.
You choose.
Although my wife probably is far enough away that isn't listening in, and I have to change the story to be actually what others would hold to be true. But I live in Barcelona, but Barcelona is not where I was born. I am a teacher, and when I was a kid, it was the last thing I ever wanted to be. So it's a bit of a strange path how my life has turned around from the things I thought I would be when I was young to what I find that I do and I love and I get to do now. I remember a few years ago I was up Costa Brava with Vern Harnish, who is one of the founders of Entrepreneurs Organization. We were talking about what we both do for a living, which is stand on stages and give talks to anywhere from 100 to 1,000 people. And I didn't know that such a thing existed as a kid. I didn't know you could get paid to stand and talk and tell stories. And you know, in a way, that's what I do. Often, my wife says that I enjoy work more than holidays. When I work, I speak, people want to hear what I have to say, they clap at the end, and they're grateful. On holiday, my daughters don't want to hear what I have to say, don't clap for me, and they're not interested in my latest learning. And I think my wife has part of a reason. I think last year, one of the things I set for myself was to improve the quality of vacation. I put a lot of effort into making sure my work is fulfilling and meaningful. I tend to just arrive to the day that it finishes and collapse. And last year, I thought that that's not a good way of using vacation time. You know, you got to be as disciplined and thoughtful and planned in how you live a fulfilling rest as in building a life, a working life that fulfills the things that you really love and has as little of the crap that you really don't want to do. So if we go back, I think the first major change, the wake up for Connor, when I was 14 years old, my father's job moved from Dublin to Chicago. And I moved from a little school in Dublin that I'd been with the same group of kids all the way through. There was about 300 in the school. And age 14, I arrive in Chicago and go to New Trier Township High School, 4,000 kids in the 4 years of high school. And in Ireland, every kid, if someone asked the question, what are you going to be when you grow up, which wouldn't have been asked because no one thought about this. In Ireland, if you'd asked me, if you'd asked any of my friends in a class, they'd say, whatever my dad does. If your dad drove a bus, you're probably going to be a bus driver. If your dad was a builder, you're probably going to be a builder. If your dad's a dentist, you'll be a dentist. No one thought about it, and no one expected your life to be some different thing. I arrive in Chicago, and of the 4,000 kids in that school with me, every single one believed that they were going to be a millionaire, that they were going to have this massive, fulfilling life. And for a kid to suddenly be surrounded by that attitude to life, that whatever you want, you can do it, is just incredible. And I often think that there's a view that over the last 30 years, the US economy has grown on average 2% per year faster than the European economy. And people say it's because it's a larger market. It's one single language. It's one single legal code across the period, the range. I think that might explain some portion of it. The huge portion of it is explained by the openness that Americans have to believing that the future can be anything you want it to be. Mm. You know, if I was in Dublin as a kid, 16, 17 years old, and I said to my friends, I've got an idea, we're going to design a video game. They'd have said, oh, that's stupid. If I was in America and said it to the group of people that I hang around with at school, they'd say, oh, wow, that's amazing. My dad knows some guy here. Hey, do you need investors? Can we get involved? Just that positivity and that belief. And I think that really transformed me. If I'd grown up and stayed in Dublin right the way through school, I probably wouldn't have been an entrepreneur. I probably wouldn't be living in Barcelona now. I would probably have just accepted that life is just this little thing. You live, you have some kids, you tick along, and you know, work isn't supposed to be meaningful. You're not supposed to create things. I'm not saying it's a better or worse life. There's oftentimes I think that what I gained in ambition, I lost in peace of mind. Because you know, I remember once in Ireland, she had a job, she got married, and when she got married, she left her job. Because in the 1970s in Ireland, a woman, as soon as you're married, you stopped working. And probably 15 years ago, I sat down with my mom and I said, don't you ever regret what could have been? You know, you were a teacher of history. You know, don't you ever regret what could have been if you didn't leave it to spend time looking after us kids? And she looked at me and she says, I feel much more for you, your sister, and your two brothers. She said, it wasn't my choice, so I can't regret. There wasn't any other option, so there's nothing to miss. You guys live in a world where everything is possible. And dealing with the fact that if you can do anything, it's a real suffering when you don't do one thing or you close down an option. And I remember this feeling of me going to my mom, you know, kindly offering empathy, and me walking away thinking, oh, she's got a lot of peace of mind. And I guess, you know, some of the challenges navigating the world we live in today is that there are far, far more opportunities, but the paths are not carved. They're not clear. And it takes a lot of emotional commitment to find a path that works for you. And, you know, my grandparents' generation, my mum's father, at the age of 21, passed an exam, got a job in the Bank of Ireland, and worked there until 65 when he retired on a 2/3 final salary pension. So, you know, the last time he had to think about career was 21 years old, he passed the exam. And that the rest was taken care of. Mm. At this lunchtime, I was listening to a webinar by a headhunter, you know, someone who's been helping CEOs move to roles that fit what their personal and professional ambitions are. And he was saying, you know, in America, it's pretty much a given thing that you'll change jobs 5 or 6 times in a career. In Spain, that's coming. In Spain, up till now, you could join a company and just kind of settle in and do your work. That's not the case anymore. And I guess we're moving from this world that my mom talks about where there weren't that many choices. But that meant there wasn't a lot of emotional baggage of regret of the paths not taken. And now you can be anything, but you can also suffer the regret of not being any one of those things.
Is there, on that path, I mean, I know you for a while and I know your resilience and still at the same time, the clarity, how you then whenever something happens, you deal with it. I mean, what are the major steps in your life where you felt like, okay, that's where I build my resilience? I mean, it's not only this phase right now. We probably got to talk about your keynote speaker as well. And I'm pretty sure, like myself, you're not on stage at the moment in Corona times. But what are the big building blocks of your life where you say, well, that was the downtime that helped me build my path? Shape it.
Yeah. So 14 moved to America, 16 moved, but not back to Ireland, moved to the UK. 18, studied psychology and artificial intelligence at Nottingham University.
With 18, or AI already?
Yes, so this would be, I went to university in 89, was it? So, or no, 91, psychology and artificial intelligence.
How come? That's interesting. Well, why that? Like, that's early for that topic.
It was early, and you know, psychology interested me because I guess having moved from Ireland to the US and then to the UK, I'd seen how different people were, how easy or difficult it is to make friends, how people relate to each other. And it just struck me, there's a lot to be learned here. You know, why study engineering and learn how to build bridges when there's something much more important, like how to make friends, how to connect with people, what trust is, how to get someone to say yes. And so, you know, I discovered that psychology is not really about that. It was about rabbits crossing mazes and rats on glass floors and looking at how perception systems work. And, you know, probably what I didn't study at university was anything about Freud, Jung, existentialism. What I've been interested from the moment I finished university was Freud and Jung, and what is it to be a human being? What are we searching for? What do we hunger for? What makes a fulfilling life? And, you know, the beginning was what makes a fulfilling life for me. So, you know, if we sort of skip forward to your question, when did I transform from a kind of lost soul copying other people's paths to get clear what my life is about? And this would be 2008, 2009. So 2008, I was on my fourth entrepreneurial startup that I had begun. We had raised a couple of rounds of venture capital. I was running a private jet airline. We had 16 aircraft. I was on the television. I was in the newspapers as, you know, the taxi jet guy, the entrepreneur changing the skies, bringing private jets to the masses. And, you know, our vision with that business was to have 150 aircraft all across Europe and bringing private jet travel to the price of 2 times first class. And in July 2008, there was an offer on my desk in the airport in Sabadell, which is just about 30 kilometers outside of Barcelona. I had an offer on my desk to buy my company for 10 million euros from the biggest jet operator in Spain. And they wanted me to come on and take a leadership role in their business, acquire completely my business. And I thought, it's worth 10 times that. I'm not signing. So September 2008 comes along, and September 2008, the 15th of September 2008, Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy. You know, initially a London, New York bank going bankrupt, how's that going to affect me? Very rapidly, I noticed, you know, there was a major crisis. Real estate was struggling, but I guarantee private jet struggled more than any business. And our revenues just fell off a cliff. We'd raised a round of venture capital probably middle of the summer, which I think is what had provoked the interest in the acquisition by Gestair. And, you know, our plan was to scale up to get to 30 aircraft, really scale up our training, really scale up our computer systems. So we had a lot of cash in the bank when September came. So I didn't have to lay anyone off. I didn't have to take any decisions September. We postponed the decisions to October, to November, to December. And each month I just watched the cash coming down. And I remember I calculated how much cash I needed to have in the bank to meet all of the obligations of the administrator of a company. So you got to be careful when you're an entrepreneur that there are criminal liability, certainly in the Spanish system. So the social security part of the payment that you should make to employees is never considered your money. Although it's in your account, it's viewed, it's their money. If you don't pay it, it wasn't your money to not pay. it was their money. And it's a criminal liability of an administrator of a company to not have the money to pay the social security part. So I was very aware of what the number was that meant that I could close the company and meet all the really serious obligations as an administrator. And I remember one morning I woke up and that was the number in the bank account. And we had to lay off all of, there was about 30 between pilots and maintenance staff and people working on sales. And, you know, each pilot had been, you know, the investment you put in to get a pilot trained up is, you know, probably between hotels in the US, weeks of certification courses, it's 100,000 euros is invested in each pilot to get them certified to fly on our aircraft. So, you know, it wasn't just seeing friends walk out of the building, it was seeing a fortune of investment just at a time when I thought we're about to go big time here. This is the project that's going to make me. So that thing that there was a deal on my table in July 2008, and by February 2009, we had laid off all of the staff. And I arrived home one night and my ex-wife said, I can't do this anymore. You need to leave. So I found myself end of February 2009, sleeping on the office floor on a mattress that we had. So we had bedrooms in our offices because when you move private jets around, you don't want to, you have people sleeping over. So there was a shower and there was bedrooms in our offices. But, you know, February 2009, March 2009, I guess just in the shock, like this shouldn't be happening to me. I couldn't understand how this could have happened. I couldn't understand. I had done nothing wrong. I had broken no laws. I had cheated no one. I had not done anything wrong. And this was not fair. This should not be happening to me. And I think for most of 2009, I was a bitter, angry victim of a cruel universe and, you know, just didn't get how this could happen. It had never happened to anyone. You know, my dad didn't have a crisis. My brothers didn't. Like, how is this happening to me? And for most of 2009, that was my state of mind. This is unfair. This shouldn't be happening. I never did anything wrong. Towards the end of 2009, and most of 2009, I was busy with court cases. So I was waking in the morning, heading to the courts, heading to the lawyers, heading to the human resources people who were helping to sort through all the crap that follows you when a business does not survive. And in fact, I paid off the final debt last year. So, you know, it's 2009 till 2010 years it took me to unravel all of the commitments and guarantees that were connected with that business. And no one tells you this when you go from employee to entrepreneur. No one tells you to be very careful about what you're agreeing to. You know, I think in a way, when I became an entrepreneur, I thought I was signing up for freedom. I thought, finally, I'm free.
Yeah,
and after point. 5 years as an entrepreneur, I had, so I was involved in 36 ice cream restaurants. I had a business that did cost management for small and medium-sized businesses with 16 employees. I had an insurance brokerage. And I remember one day realizing none of this was liquid. All of my money was tied up in these operations, and it would probably take me 5 to 10 years if I wanted to slowly get the cash out of this. Mm. And it struck me, what an idiot. I did this to become free. 5 years in, I realized I'm the least free I've ever been in my life. As an employee, you get your month's salary, you walk away, you've got everything, you're free. How could I possibly have seen it so backwards?
That's
but yeah, so you got to be very careful as an entrepreneur about how it works, what's a good deal and what's not a good deal. So 2009, towards the end of 2009, court cases are coming to an end. And to be honest, when I stopped being busy, I just gave up. And there was a time towards the end of 2009 that I just didn't get out of bed. 4 days, just didn't get out of bed. Just didn't feel there was any point. There's nothing left. Like, I've had my go at it. I've had my attempt at life. I've had my attempt at success, and it's game over.
It's like Leo Tolstoy, the death of Ivan Ilyich.
The death of Ivan Ilyich. So very much a feeling. And, you know, there, I think those 4 days, I was just asking myself over and over and over again, why me? Why me? Why is this happening to me? Why me? And after 4 days of just being in a state of, you know, lying in the bed, half asleep, half awake, I remember I just had a moment of clarity and just knew I am never asking this question again. I am never asking this question again. And it wasn't like a voice in my head. It was just, I know right now that that question is never going to be asked again in my life. And I said to myself, I will never ask myself a question that doesn't serve me. And three things came clear to me in that moment, which, you know, the way I would describe is faith, hope, and love. Faith that everything that I had done up to that point was the best that Connor, at the age and with the experience, could have done. The girlfriend that I left in a way that I wish I didn't when I was 23. That was the best that Connor at 23 could do. The fact I could regret by 33 is I was wiser. Not signing the deal to sell the company 3 months before Lehman's bankruptcy, that was the best that Connor at that point could do. And I remember this element of faith was just a huge compassion for myself, for all the versions of myself in the past, for all the flawed decisions, but they're flawed from where I look now. But back then, they were the best decision that me at that age with that experience could have taken. And faith is you and I, there's a reason we are talking right now. The listener listening to this podcast, there's a reason that they're hearing my voice and your voice at this time. And if we pay attention, there is something for us here. We may discover it now. We may discover it in a week. We may never discover it. But to me, faith is this, that there's nothing broken. There's nothing we've done wrong. There's nothing to regret. A regret is a wonderful thing. It means you're wise. To regret your past action is to be wise now. But you need to know that 10 years from now, you're going to look back and see how unwise.
You regret it, yeah.
So you're gonna look back with compassion on the Christoph of today, 2020.
So what were, like, faith? What were the other two?
So faith is that you know, how we got to this point is the way we were supposed to get to this point. Hope, action changes the future. Only action. Thinking about calling your father changes nothing. Only picking up the phone and dialing the digits. It doesn't matter whether it connects. Just the mere act of acting has begun a change in you and in the world. And, you know, so often we stay at our intent. I love, there's a saying from the Arbinger Institute, we judge ourselves by our intention, we judge others by their action. How much better if we judged ourselves by action and judged others by their intention? And I love a definition that I like of the word love is a generous interpretation of the actions of others. So a loving relationship is one in which, you know, the partner arrives 10 minutes late and you are you okay? Did anything happen? A non-loving relationship is, you know, what the hell, we agreed 10 p.m. What are you, you know, this can't keep going on. What sort of respect are you showing? Love is to be generous in how we interpret the actions of another.
But how, when you look back to that moment, you said like it came to you like after 4 days and then it hit you at a certain moment. I mean, we've been talking throughout the last months and years, and you know a little bit of my situation and the ups and the downs, and I could always feel like you have a different view and resilience on things and how you see them. Like, did this, when you go back to that moment, and I can really feel when you told that story, I mean, that's your strengths, like giving a story, I could really feel that story. And I thought like, oh, wow. I remember 2008, it hit me. The crisis hit me in the company really hard. That was a really deep, deep, deep point. And now another crisis hit. And I sometimes think, do we really learn? Are these moments coming? And my thought here is it that some people realize it a bit more clear in their mind, and do other people are just like foggy on their mind and don't realize it and repeat the same and the same thing? I mean, I would wish for that moment. How do you do that?
Well, I guess there's a range, there's some good stuff to go there. So one, I'd say we'll finish faith, hope, and love. Faith is everything that has taken us to be here together, you and me talking, everything that's taken the listener to be listening in this moment was what needed to happen for us to be here. And if we're paying attention, we will discover something. We may not know right now, but it will serve us. Hope, action changes the future. So when you think about doing something but don't do it, nothing changes. It's only when it gets converted into action, when you decide to call someone and you call them, that changes the future. And no matter where you are, no matter what state your life is in, there is always an action you can take to shift the path of your future. And love is that at the center of all the questions I ask myself in my head. So any question that I allow to float around my head or in my journal, love is that there's always another person at the center of the question. So what does my father need from me today? What does my mother need from me today? What does Christoph need from me in this time that we are together? Love is that all the questions that go around inside my head, if my question is, what am I going to get from this? What do I get from being on this podcast? What do I get from being father to my daughter? What do I get from my dad at the moment in this time? This is an act of selfishness. An act of love is letting go of self and serving another. And an act of love is an act with no strings attached. You can't transaction love. So if I give you something, you know, one example would be to my daughter, sometimes I'll find myself saying, I love you, Ali. And the silence hurts because it wasn't an act of love.
I know exactly what you mean. My daughter then says, she's also silent. And sometimes she says, angenommen in Deutsch, like, yep, taken. And then she chooses carefully for herself when she says that. My son is a bit different. He's like, he's saying that a lot, although he's three, but I know exactly what you mean. And I learned from her what you mean by now saying that there are no strings attached, like not having an intention in doing that. I just shared with Michael this morning, we didn't have an intention with the podcast doing anything, just like having a conversation. And I can feel what you mean. But it's still sometimes very difficult. Or realizing when something happens, you say like, shit, I did that with an intention, although I intended not to. And like, you know what I mean? Like you wiggle around that.
Well, I like that there's the definition I most love of success comes from Pema Chodron. Pema Chodron is an American housewife that became a Buddhist monk in her late 50s.
Okay. I have a picture in my mind.
So Pema Chodron, and she has a book called When Things Fall Apart, which is probably quite a good book or a good title, certainly, for this moment in time. And she says, success is you're lying in your bed tonight, you're about to fall asleep, your eyes are closed, and in the last few seconds of waking consciousness, you review your day and you find a moment during the day that you were going to react and you didn't react. today is a success. And she says, and tonight, if you're lying in your bed, your eyes are closed, and you're reviewing your day, and you don't find a single moment where you were about to react and you didn't react, today is still a success because you're aware, and tomorrow is likely to be better.
I love that.
And I think, you know, there's a need to be very compassionate with one's own self. Yeah, a human being is a beautifully flawed thing. And, you know, you can torture yourself by comparing yourself to perfection or what you could have done or what you should have done. And part of this dichotomy to me, faith is that the past is perfect. Hope is that the future is completely under my control. And, you know, from 2009, 10, 11, 12, I spent 20 weeks a year in a little fisherman's hut in the Costa Brava. I shared a little fisherman's hut on a little beach. There's 20 houses right on the beach. You know, my door is 10 meters from the sea. You have to park your car 600 meters away and hike in, carrying all the water, all the food. Well, in fact, there is a well, but you want to make sure it's rained before you use the well, otherwise you're going to get salty water. And you know, from 2009, 10, 11, 12, I pretty much spent 20 weeks of each year just by myself in that little house, going for walks in the national park that was around it, cooking breakfast, cooking lunch, cooking dinner, and writing and thinking and reading. And I guess you're thinking a lot about these ideas, thinking a lot about what I'd learned, thinking about a lot about what I was trying to do with my life and the way I was thinking about life and what is important and who is important and what it wasn't so much what do I want to be, it was kind of how do I not get where I was again. And I very seriously wrote a document for myself, which is how to not get here again. Which, you know, is something I've done a few times. So that isn't my only business failure. I had a previous business that we sold, but we sold to get out of it. It was not a good business. And when we sold, I remember I took a few days to go away and just write down everything I was feeling at the time, all of my thoughts, so I can remember. Because in life, you forget quite quickly. And, you know, my worry is if you're not writing down each day what it's like to be in quarantine, writing down what it's like right now, in a month, in 3 months, in 6 months, you've got no idea how it felt to be Christoph at this moment in time. And, you know, for me, when I was 14 years old, when I moved from Dublin to Chicago, I hated the experience, but I met the teacher who has had the greatest positive experience of my life. And the teacher's name is Eric Matz. He was a biology teacher. And there were three things that Mr. Matz did that, you know, I think have had this transformative effect on me. Number one, he started every class, he would walk in and say, "It's a great day." And if you can imagine an apathetic, cynical Irish guy sat at the back of class thinking like, what the hell, this is this, you know, the epitome of American rah, rah. But day after day, he came in and he didn't just say it, he meant it. He believed it. He lived it. So, you know, but every day he said it and it started to become infectious. The second thing that I remember that no other professor or teacher ever did, he took the textbook, the very first class, he held up the textbook of biology and he asked the class, how much is this worth? And a bunch of 14-year-olds, $30. It was $32. He says, yeah, $32. If at the end of this year, you have learned everything in this book and passed all the tests, you're worth $32 more. That's not what this course is about. If at the end of this year, you look at systems and how they interact. You look at a tree and a squirrel and the grass, and you think about how each of those systems interacts, and you have curiosity and you have interest, and you have a way of thinking about how systems impact each other all around us, you're worth infinitely more. That's what this class is about. And you know, this is cynical Irish guy, 14 years old, thinking, what is this? The third thing he had us do was the last 5 minutes of every class with him, the rule, pen touching paper in your journal. He handed us all out a journal. And day one, what's the point of this? Like, what does he want? Day two, he told us he wasn't going to read it. I thought, what's this for? Like, he's not even going to read it. It's not going to get a grade for this. Day five, my mum said something interesting to me today. Day six, my brother was looking a bit out of sorts in the car. And I took this habit. And every day I have paused for a few minutes and written, at the very least, where I am, who I'm with, what thoughts are in my head, what questions I have. Sometimes it's many pages. Sometimes it's just a note that reminds me of where I am. Very often if I'm on a flight, I'll just stop and write down the number of the flight, where I am, what's happening, present tense. Very much of the view that, you know, if I don't capture my state of mind right now, me in 6 months has no idea who I was 6 months ago.
You taught me this in Washington, and I was reminded of it, and just took a long break when Corona came working, and I realized a couple of days ago, shit, I could not recall it if I didn't write it. But you made a point now, even if you don't write anything, at least write where you are and who you're with. I love that. Really, really love it.
And someone once told me that the greatest leadership book for you is your own life, well documented. How do you learn who you are? You can't, if you don't write, you can't even remember who you were yesterday, what you felt like at breakfast this morning. We think we remember who we were. We think we live. You pull out a photo. Are you sure you remember? I can pull out a photo and pull out a, I've got a shelf over here that has all the books. Someone once asked, what if that was lost? I said, it doesn't really matter. The point is not the books. The point is processing it. That I've lived everything twice. Once as a lived experience, and once as I relive it, as I just remember my days.
I think you don't
need to go too organized in this. If you just began, I remember back when I was 27, I took 6 months to travel around the world. So 27 was backpacking for a year, 25 was backpacking for 6 months. And my diary was just, all the dates, and it was just three or four words for each place. And it just meant that, and you can remember once there's a couple of words, you remember one name, one thing you were doing that day. And one of those books, so I'm trying to remember, was Peru, the Lima airport. I arrived and LAN Peru had gone bankrupt overnight as we were flying in. So we got on the flight. In the air, the airline went bankrupt. So when we landed, there was no staff getting the bags off the plane. There was no staff handling anything. And in that chaos, I lost my journal. And I bought a new, a few days later, I bought a new journal. And I remember trying to go back through the previous 6 months and remember. And I thought, you can't. You can't remember your life.
Yeah.
You can remember what you think your life was like, but you can't remember the reality of what it felt to be lived.
And I just went through the journals back in Washington, and I've been switching journals big ones, small ones, back and forth. And this is me like being organized doing that. Michael is way more structured than I. You're way more structured. I'm like,
well, the key is it has this thing here. So this is a pen holder. And
I have this, I love it.
If someone gives me a book, the first thing I'll check, does it have, you can either jam it in the binder, you can jam it here, you can hook a pen over here. But if the journal doesn't have a way of jamming a pen in so the pen is always with it, I'll give it away as a gift.
Do you remember in Washington, you gave us a task. I mean, you taught the class of speaking, and everyone taking this class, like we were the presidents of EO, and we had to give a speech. And I know there were some people liked that and others didn't. And I kind of thought it was interesting, and I considered myself being quite a decent speaker. And then you came on the plate, and I'm like, okay, holy shit, that's a whole new structure. And you went through the structure. You remember that the Aristotle, rhetorica, the basic structure of a speech. And I will never forget that. And I didn't have an idea for a speech, I would say, a few hours before I had to give it. And I'm like, shit, I was talking about a book. You might remember that my grandma, she had this this thing that she would give us a book for Christmas. No matter which book it is, we could choose a book. And so you would make a proper decision. And I remembered I wanted a certain book that a guy was writing to help back then the very weak German government to survive certain threats during the Weimar Republic. And he wrote a book about the communication of what you should do as a state in order to like keep your people together. And this book was misused by the Third Reich, misused for communication reasons. But he has had the clear intent of making it a good thing. And he's the founder of marketing and all that stuff. This book was like back then, I think, $800 or something. And my grandma bought it. And I'm like, you get goosebumps when you read it because you see the intent and what was made for it. And it showed me, because it was all about communication, the power of communication. So I was sharing that story. And since I obviously didn't have the book, I used my journal, the orange journal back then. And I put that in the air, and the room was looking at this book. And I was sharing that story. And I remember everyone after that talk came to me, can I see that book? I'm like, sorry, that was just my journal. I just wanted to show my book. But that was the power of you teaching speeches and then using what you have in the journal.
There's one of the things that in speaking I think the ancient Greeks had two ways of thinking about time: Chronos and Kairos. And Chronos is the time that a clock shows. A minute is a minute, and every minute is 60 seconds long, and no minutes are longer, no minutes are shorter. It's time as it flows. Kairos is another way of thinking of time, and that's there are moments when everything stops and the whole future of the universe depends on what happens in this moment. And Kairos is something that comes in storytelling. Someone who tells a good story slows down time and creates the sense that that moment, that decision, that gift from your granny to you changed everything. And that before and after there was a different Christoph. And when you tell that story, Kairos is what gives meaning to human life. It makes us feel that there are special moments worth living towards, worth living for, worth creating in our relationships. And what I'm interested in speaking is, I hate bland, generic, vague answers. When I listen to a podcast, in about a minute, I can tell, right, this guy, there's nothing new. He's just giving the brochure talk. Kairos, I've always been interested in this idea of how do you leave someone with an idea, a thought, or an emotion that lasts with them long, long after the speech. And you turn that book into a symbol of something that everyone is searching for, a special message, something that, and I guess, as humans, we love the idea that, if a piece of clothing touched Bono from U2, it's a different piece of clothing. It's a much, much more valuable. Because in us is a huge desire to believe that there are objects of importance, people of importance, moments that matter.
Do you know the origins of new work? You remember this guy we met who came up with the term, the Friedrich Bergmann, and we met him in this year again in February, and we're like making something out of that. And there were certain moments that really touched me when I realized that this new work thing comes out of a deep, deep crisis. But exactly what you just said, this chaos time concept, changing everything after that. And I could feel how he was giving his life, not only to a term that is like, yeah, we changed the way we work and it's all a bit more fancy. No, but to a whole new concept of how people live together, do stuff together, and also communicate in a more valuable way. Like, as I get it from you, like you give me undivided attention. I love that. It's it's something I just wrote it down in my journal. So this is my journal entry for the gift to myself that you just gave me, this reminder of that concept. And yeah, ever since then, I'm always thinking, okay, if I start a speech now, what would Connor say? I'm like, oh shit.
Well, I think I sometimes put at the top of a journal page, WWWD. What would Warren do?
Podcast episode 22. We have to repeat that.
Podcast episode 22, Warren Rustand. And, for me, really is someone that showed me that a good leader is a great human being. And a good leader is not just a leader at work. A good leader leads in family, leads in their health, leads with their friends, leads in their community. And I don't think before I'd met Warren and got to spend time with Warren in Washington with the EO Leadership Academy, I'd ever met someone that was 360 degrees. I've met plenty of people that were huge financial successes, but a mess in their family. I've met people who've got wonderful families, but haven't got a dime to their name. I've met people that are wonderfully giving to their community, but they've left some broken kids back home that have never felt supported and loved. And I, probably before Warren, had a sense that leadership is a kind of unbalanced game where you got to sacrifice something in order to be extreme at work. And Warren, to me, is a demonstration you don't have to be. I remember my first long-term girlfriend. This would be from the age of 20 to 22. We met the final week of university. And I remember just thinking, like, no, 3 years just floating around like an idiot, and I meet you in a festival the last week before we finish. And she, I think, was 20 years more mature than me. We were both 21, but she was far more mature in the way she saw life and thought about life. And she told me, success is 2 out of 3 of work, family, or friends. And we got to pick 2. And she said, if you pick 1, you can go a long way, but it's going to be an empty success. If you pick 3, there's always going to be someone who's willing to put in more than you. Only if you pick 2 and close down 1 can you have success. And she had decided that work and me were the 2 that she was going to put effort in. So friends, community, she was going to work, and me and family. And I hated this idea that you had to close down entire sections of your life at 21 in order to achieve success and I would talk about this, I would seek out other things, and almost a lot of my life is how to be so efficient in each area that you have time for all of them. with Warren, I learned it's not about time. It's about priorities. It's like who and what really matters, and you never let it drop. And you know, he'll often say there's no such thing as stress. If you know who's important, what's the decision? Should you be at home with your kid who's struggling and can't sleep, or should you be closing the 20 million deal? Which can you do tomorrow? Which can you do in 10 years?
I remember exactly when we were discussing the stress topic, and some people in the room were like, but there is stress. And we're like, no, there's no stress. No, I don't get the concept of stress. And then understanding his idea of priorities, I still have that in my keynotes today as an example. Like, listen to the word. Well, so Connor, we need another 3 hours, definitely. We're hitting the hour. Which it's hard for me because I'm just warming up, and I'm really enjoying this gift that you give to me of undivided attention here right now.
Maybe you need to go to the Tim Ferriss podcast.
Exactly.
The 3-4 hour conversation, spending a full day together.
Yeah. That's a new format. Like after Corona, it's a bit more difficult in distance, and I would definitely say we need to spend time in Barcelona and do that.
Definitely one of the things I did early on in this, and I think what you call this time is important. You can call it confinement. You can call it quarantine. A friend of mine calls it retreat. You can call it what you want, but my choice to call it retreat changes the way I treat my time, changes the way I think about it. So I've decided to call it retreat. You were interested in moments and people that have shaped who I am. And I talked about being 14 years old and moving to Chicago. I talked about being 33, 34 years old, 2008, bankruptcy, divorce, and you know, going to the depths of just, why am I here? Why am I still alive? I failed. And then finding I'm still alive. My mom still loves me. My dad still loves me. My friends still seem to like something in me. Like, what do they like in me if I failed to, I don't have a business, I have no money, what is left? For me, before I started the current business, Vistage, I spent 6 months in conversation with a mentor called Harry O'Neill. And Harry O'Neill, so he's probably 70 now, back then was 65, was the head of Heidrick & Struggles business in Asia in financial services, so headhunting, people, recruitment. And he was my mentor for 6 months. And the decision that I had him help me think through was whether I acquired the license to operate Vistage in Spain or not. And with Harry, I guess when we first had that conversation, I would have been 43, he would have been 65, so 20, 22 years difference. He was definitely a success in any measure of what I thought was. So this was a wonderful opportunity to talk to someone that had gone down a path that I'd like to be able to follow. And in our first conversation, I asked him, Harry, what's a good day? And Harry answered, and I almost fell off my seat at his answer. His answer was going to the office. And when he'd answered that question, I'd spent all of my life thinking the office is a necessary evil in order to get some stuff done and then all good stuff happens outside. I couldn't believe that his answer to what's a good day is the office, going to the office. And I said, so I spent that hour ask him, what do you mean by the office? And there's three things that he told me were important in the office. One, the physical space. The office of Heidrick & Struggles in Hong Kong, he's been part of it for 30 years. The layout, the design, the paint, the furniture, the artworks that are on the wall, he has personally been involved with every bit of it. And if he was in that space alone, it's a space that he wants to spend his time in. So he said the first thing, a physical space that you want to be in. Regardless of what you're doing or who else is there, it's a beautiful physical space that brings out the best in you. And that's going to be different for each person. But you've got to get control of the physical space where you're going to spend your time and become conscious of what gives you energy, what sucks your energy, what inspires you, what tires you. Mm-hmm. And you don't do that by spending 5 minutes. It's an iterative process of learning what gives you energy, how much light do you need, what time of day do you want the sun shining in which area. So the first thing is he loves the physical space of the whole office. He loves his office, what he looks at, what's on the desk, the photos. The second, he loves the people he works with. As the managing partner, he's recruited every single one of them. And his decision is not, can they make money for the business? It's, do I want to see this person every day? Do I want to build something together? And he said, you know, if you're the leader of a business and it tires you to be around some of the people in your team, you're a fucking idiot. What are you waiting for? The most important thing as a leader, as an entrepreneurial leader, is to surround yourself with people that make you better. And make you better doesn't mean you just have a good time and have drinks and hang out. They want the best for you and they want you to want the best for them. They will tell you when you let them down and they will accept it when you tell them that they haven't been up to their own best. So he said, you know, every single person in that office he has hired and they're there because he wants to see them. He wants to know what's going on in their lives. And the third thing, he loves his clients. He works for clients that he wants to see them succeed. And if he sees that the client, the individual he's going to work with, is not someone that he wants to work with, he will not take the job. And he said, you know, if you're not going to be able to make these choices at 20, you know, at 20, you don't get to design the layout of the office. A new intern starting at Black Boat doesn't go, Christoph, we're going to change the layout here. No, at 20, you begin to build some skills, build some reputation, build some influence. And it could take you 20 years to move through to the point where you actually have a bit of a say over the layout of the physical space. You start to have a bit of a say over who is on the teams working with you. You start to have a bit of a say of which clients you choose to work with. But the only way that by 50 you start to really have a shine in your eyes and be fulfilled is that you are in control of these three things in your life.
I just wrote it down. The office, the people you work with, the clients. I just had the moment this evening when we were packing stuff. I'm like, oh, I'm really thankful working with the people we have. And you're absolutely right. Like when people left or had to go, that's definitely a moment that I can remember saying like that feels like a relief, and it's very, yeah. Also with the clients, I mean, yeah.
Oh, and you know, people, I think there's a book called Who, and it's a big thick book about recruiting. You don't need to read the whole book. The grain that is so powerful in there is, you know, a good team member, a good employee is someone, if all contracts were null and void and, you know, the whole German legal system was thrown out, all agreements are gone, who would you enthusiastically rehire? Anyone not on that list, you got to begin the work to either change their attitude, change where they're working, or change which company they're working for. And you know, this morning I was speaking to some of the leaders of Vistage in Spain, and the theme was, you get what you tolerate. So have very few rules, but absolute black and white, someone oversteps, you are brutal. So not many rules, but what you decide is a rule, you make very clear. And, you know, I say, if someone breaks an expectation of mine the first time, I'm responsible for not articulating the expectations clear enough. If they do it a second time, they will be helped to find another place to conduct their efforts. And I think, you know, Warren Rustan, one of the reasons he doesn't have stress is he's so clear what is and what is not acceptable.
You know what I'm thinking of right now? You said that in Washington that you should never say the words, "Did you understand me?" But you should say, "Did I make myself clear?" And I say that to my kids in a very careful, conscious way, but they repeat the sentence. And I'm just realizing right now, this sentence is from you. And I do that very consciously, saying, "Did I make myself clear?" Because I'm usually thinking, well, of course I make myself clear, but I'm too often realizing, no, not at all. I'm not at all making myself clear. So I have to ask that.
I love my father had a saying, context is worth 90 IQ points.
Context is
worth context. 90. So, you know, when you say the answer is whatever, mm-hmm. without the context, without all of the factors around it, the other person is operating with 10 IQ. If you give them the context, there's very few people that can't go, I can see how you're looking at it. And, you know, another of the beliefs, and I think, you know, Connor pre 33, 34 years old was one person, Connor post was another. And, you know, I very much have a sense of my life as two lives, 0 to 33 and 33 till today. And, you know, my eldest daughter was 2 at that time. Mm. And one of the things that my EO forum, we've done quite a lot on retreats, is write a letter to someone to open 10 mm-hmm. or 15 years in the future. Mm-hmm. And I've got 6 letters that I've written to my daughter that she'll open when she's 18.
Wow.
You know, one was before she was born, one was when she was 1, one is when she's 2, another when she's 5, another when she's 10. And each time it's usually on a retreat with EO or a Vistage group. And, you know, I sit down for a couple of hours to write about who I am now, who I see her now, and then picturing the moment that she opens this letter. Who is the girl of 18 opening this letter? What will she be like? What do I hope for her? And the letter that I wrote when, you know, post 2009, as I was writing it, I realized I have this feeling that I'm the same age as her. The second version of Connor has begun about the same time you were born. And I look like a 40-year-old speaking to a 13-year-old, but no, I'm a little 5-year-old inside the body of a 40-year-old adult trying to make sense with what's going on in life. And the thing that I think changes, I don't just see me as that. I see every person around us as a 5-year-old trapped inside the clothes and the body of an adult. And the 5-year-old is doing their best to figure out what the hell's going on. And
that helps. That helps as a picture sometimes when people react in a bad way as well.
Yep. So, you know, there, you know, the framing, the context, because when I say context gives 10 IQ or gives 90 IQ points, looking at a person as a deliberately malicious adult is a context. Looking at a person as a 5-year-old doing their best to figure out a way through is context. And we get to frame the context we put into the world. We get to interpret everything. And I guess, you know, that time, 2008, 2009, was when I decided to take absolute conscious control over the way that I interpret life. And it doesn't mean that it always works. I think there's a story that an American Indian grandfather is speaking with his grandson, and he tells the grandson, each of us carries 2 wolves.
Wolves, the black and the white.
The black and the white, the good wolf
and the
bad wolf. And the grandson says, which wolf will win? And the grandfather says, the one you feed. Now, what I have learned, and 2008, 2009, I went through crisis, 2010, 11, I processed it. It doesn't make it any easier to live through quarantine now. It doesn't make you any stronger or better, because I think those two wolves, you could go for 10 years never feeding the bad wolf a single morsel of food. It's not dead. It's just
it
as hungry.
It will pop up.
It'll pop out.
Yeah.
And, you know, Warren has always struck me as he just came fully formed. I'm broken. And if I don't have sort of routines of remembering who I am by writing stuff down, remembering who I am by reading things that inspire me, remembering who I am, you know, and I'll still screw things up. Luckily now, I tend to screw them up, and 3 minutes later, I've realized it's me who is contributing to this problem, not my wife, not my daughter. Whereas 20 years ago, it took me 6 weeks, and I never fully accepted that it was me that created the problem.
I can feel it.
So on that note,
yeah.
If you go to a place you love with people that you love and work on problems for people that you want to see succeed, you'll have a fulfilling life.
Okay, that's I definitely have something here, Connor. We as I say, we could go on for another hour. I have one last thing I always ask, and you get a bit more challenge. Usually people can say their top five books, but I know that you need challenges. If I had like one last book to read, which one to pick?
Well, the answer, if you had one last music to listen to, because I've thought the last 7 minutes of my life, I would be listening to the Pachelbel Canon. And the Pachelbel Canon to me is perfection in music. In terms of books, like you see behind me here, that there's many books.
But give me one, if you would say, like I could choose one. The one pick you would take and say, Christoph, this is one read.
Forced down to that, Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning.
And give me one sentence why. One.
And Viktor Frankl, there's always a choice. No matter what the situation, there's always a choice of our response. And you can take away a man's freedom, but you can never take away his choice of response. And this idea that there's always a choice before our response. And what it is to be human is to have a choice before you respond. And I often think, you know, what a story is a case that, you know, 99 out of 100 would never succeed, but a human did. And that's a story. Like, why did this one person overcome what everyone else didn't do? And the human being, when you decide to commit to something, you know, if you know, what I learned with Vistage is, when I began, I went to the UK and I spent some time with a leadership group. And they asked me, you know, Connor, you know, for practice tomorrow, would you process an issue? You know, bring a theme to the group. And at the time I thought, life's good. I don't have many major problems. So the issue I brought was, how do I build Vistage in Spain? I thought, let's put it on the table. And over the next hour, I was asked questions about why it was important to me, what I was thinking about, what other factors were at play. And what happens in Vistage is there's a reframing of what the others think the real underlying issue is. And the reframing of this issue was, how does Connor wake up motivated every day for the rest of his life? Because if that happens, Vistage is going to be an institution. Everything you touch is going to be an institution. Everything that you can touch and for 50 years wake up motivated, you're going to make a huge difference in the world. But if you sacrifice your joy, your fulfillment, your relationships, your family for 5 years, for 8 years, for 10 years to go faster than you need to on some area of life, there's a day, 5, 8, 10 years from now, that you're going to wake up and think, what the fuck am I doing? Like, is this worth it? I've paid this price. Am I re-? And you know, my life 0 to 34 was always sacrificing today for the future.
I would say that.
The, you know, what I learned from Warren Rustand is that that's a stupid game.
Yeah.
Be here now and get the, you know, be the best you can with the person you're in now, and don't overthink things.
Let's leave it with that. I think that's I work with that, and I can definitely leave the podcast also with this quote of Viktor Frankl and this image. My friend, thank you for this very, very, very nice evening, and thank you for being in the podcast.
A pleasure, Christoph. Dankeschön. Gute Nacht.
Gute Nacht.